and welcome to the Morbid Anatomy Transmission. I'm your host, Molly McBride Jacobson. On this episode, I'm talking to Divya Ananthuraman, who is one of the taxidermists in residence at the Morbid Anatomy Museum. In addition to displaying and selling her own bewitching pieces, she teaches workshops for beginners and old pros alike to learn how to stuff their very own fauna friends. Where did you first encounter taxidermy, and what got you into it?
So my first encounter with, I guess, actual taxidermy on its own was probably when I was younger. My mom was a biology teacher, and she had a lot of, probably not like what people would consider like taxidermy. It was more like study skins or, you know, jarred specimens and things like that. And going to natural history museums was sort of where I saw taxidermy for the first time when I was young.
And what attracted you to taxidermy as an art form?
So the way I got into taxidermy was also, you know, around the same time when I was younger. I would go outside and collect like rocks and seashells and things like that. And, you know, I just had this like little box of treasures. And then one day I saw this lizard crawl into our bug zapper and it died. And I felt like this is my first experience with death, or the first one I can recall, at least. So I was like 5 or 6 years old, and I saw this happen, and I felt so bad for it. I was like, you know, I don't really care about lizards, and they're crawling around. Like, I don't really look at them. Like, I just kind of, like, run around after them and make mischief, but I'm not, like, I was like, I've never felt so emotional over a lizard until I saw one lose its life. So after that, I thought, this poor thing, but I was also really curious. I was like, well, I can at least now touch a lizard and see, you know, it won't run away from me, or it won't, you know, the thing will, it won't, like, react to me. I can touch it and sort of look at it and, you know, see what it's like. I can see all the little textures on its skin. I can see the tiny little toes. And so my instinct was, you should put it in the box with your other little treasures and it will be fine. And, you know, it wasn't a big lizard at all. It was probably, like, I don't know, 2 inches at the most. It was one of those little brown gecko type of things that runs around in Florida. And so it was in this box, and it stunk after, like, it didn't even take that long. It's hot down there, so it stunk after, like, a day, and, you know, it was found and thrown away, and my mom was like, you can't just put something like this in a box. You need to, you know, it needs to be preserved. Like, it's not like a plant where it will just dry out. It's degradable organic matter in there. So that's when I just sort of was more, I became interested in preservation of, just preservation in general, like preservation of like animal skins, also like preservation of plants, and, you know, just how we can take organic matter and preserve it. So the whole idea of like I was drawn more to the bigger idea before I was drawn to taxidermy as a particular art. So as I grew older, either my friends would gift me books or I would go and buy books about taxidermy. I also would buy like vintage stuff that I found. I thought of having it as something that supplemented the bigger picture of being an artist. I was like, this is one thing I'll do as part of like all of my weird art stuff. Well, the way it became a career from a hobby was after sort of like reading and watching videos and doing all these sort of self-teaching. You know, I was sort of doing this in a bubble because I was like, you know, I think this is cool, but some people might think it's kind of weird, and I don't really know if I want to talk about it that much, or, you know, I kind of do, but I kind of don't. So, you know, only like my really closest friends were like, she plays with roadkill, it's fine. After doing it more and more and meeting more people who are into it, I became more comfortable with it. I took a class at Morbid Anatomy and actually met other people who were into it. And that was really cool because it sort of became this aha moment of like, oh, you're into this, other people are into it. It's weird, but it's not weird, and there's this greater appreciation for it.
Did you teach yourself totally, or
oh, yeah.
Did anybody teach you?
So about 4 years ago, after I took that class at Morbid Anatomy, I was just like, I was looking for someone who did bigger stuff, because I was like, you know, I'm doing small stuff, but I want to learn, like, I may not be interested in doing something large and being, like, a big game specialist or something, but I want to know, you know, what how it's done commercially. So I found someone upstate who was kind enough to take on this, like, girl with tons of questions, and is like, as long as you, you know, clean up and help me sweep the floor and do all the dirty work, you can, you know, you can watch and learn. And that sort of also boosted my confidence a lot, because when you see someone you know, when you see someone doing it for real, like, I feel like immersion is the best way of learning.
Okay, so walk me through the process of mounting. Is that what we call it?
Yeah,
mounting?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, from start to finish.
Okay, so you start with a raw specimen and you skin it. So to skin something, it's a lot like taking off a bodysuit. That's always what I call it because it's the only way I can remotely think of it.
Literally what it is.
Yeah, it's literally, yeah, it's literally what it is. It's a suit on the body. So the big misconception is people think like, oh, it's taxidermy, guts are going to be flying everywhere and like there's going to be blood, it's going to be bleeding, it's going to, you know, there are all these like waterworks that are going to happen. And you know, when it's done right, and especially if you're using something that's been frozen or something that's not like roadkill that's been sitting out for 3 months or something, the gross level is probably that of going to like the butcher section of the grocery store. So yeah, after you skin something, you have the skin and you have the carcass. So the next step would be to clean the skin off. There are lots of connective tissue and fat and all this fascia and just all of this goo that sticks to the skin. You want to clean all of that off, and that step is called fleshing. So then after your skin is fleshed, you want to wash off all of the, you know, during this process there could be blood on it or there could be any staining or any fat or any grease. And then after that, I make a form. So the key to making a form is to use a lot of reference. The key to mounting, you know, the key to like successful mounting is to use a lot of reference and to really pay attention to the anatomy, pay attention to all the little quirks of whatever you're mounting, whether it's, you know, a mouse or a monkey, like, you know, it's all about the individual anatomy of that creature. You know, there could be 5 people in a class and they could be working on rabbits or something. And even though they're all rabbits, they're 5 rabbits, they're about the same weight, they're about the same size. Like, there could be, you know, there are still little quirks between each rabbit. After the form is built, what you then do after you have your tanned or preserved or powdered skin and your complete form, you then mount it. You take your skin and you mount it on the form. And a big misconception about that, or a lot of people think like, okay, I have my skin and I have my form, I'm just gonna put it on and sew it up. Like, it sounds really easy, but there are lots of like little nuances that need to happen. So all of the folds in the skin, all of the creases in the skin for like the thighs and the knees and, you know, the crotch, the armpits, like all of those areas need to be, you know, the skin needs to be manipulated around the form in order for it to fit and look natural. And that's really the taxi part of taxidermy. It means taxidermy is from the Greek to move skin or to arrange skin. And once you have your skin mounted around the form and sewn up, then it goes into detail work like, you know, sort of arranging and pinning the expression on the face and on the eyes and doing things like that. So that's sort of, I think, my short version of it's a long
that's very
short version.
Involved.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really involved.
You host workshops, The Morbid Anatomy, where people can learn beginner taxidermy, which I will talk about a little bit later. But how do most amateurs start out with taxidermy?
Most people who come to the workshops that we do at the museum, because we're not into hunting or anything like that, they come because they want to learn like rogue taxidermy, or they want to learn, you know, how can I, you know, what's the right way for me to, you know, to approach this medium without, or to approach this art form without having to actually kill something or take something's life, or how, you know, how can I do this with things that are like, you know, food byproducts or we say roadkill, but we also want everyone to be legally collecting roadkill. We don't want people to just be, it's not as simple as just like picking something up and running away with it. Like, that's not what we encourage at all. There are lots of laws around it. So yeah, I think that's how people who come to our workshops in New York City get into it. They want to know how they can do small, cute little animals that would just normally be like food byproducts. But I think most people overall, like on a larger scheme, of course, I would say they get into it because of hunting. And, you know, in a lot of like, I feel like in the city we're very isolated from, you know, that reality. Like, you know, that's the way of life for people. Like, people will, you know, they'll eat the food, they'll eat the meat, they'll use the hide, and, you know, they'll mount the head. Like, you know, I always have a hard time when someone comes to the class and it's just like, well, all the hunters suck. And I'm like, no, they don't all suck. Like, we can't say that. There's not, like, I don't think there's really one way or another way that's right. Like, ethics are so, you know, it's so subjective. It's like someone has to do what they feel is right, and, of course, what is correct within the laws of the state and city or country that they're living in. So
yeah. If you know, what is the history of taxidermy and where did it start?
So it's really, taxidermy has a really interesting history, and I like to say, I like to think it starts kind of with, you know, the Egyptians and this, like, and even before that, just these ancient, like, the ancient art of preservation, you know, people who would be assigned with a task of preserving something, whether it was, you know, the Egyptians with mummies or anything else. They were these, like, really highly revered people, and it was this secret art form, and it's really romantic, I think, of, like, you know, these, like, I don't know, I picture them as these, like, these members of royalty or these members of society, at least, you know, not from royal, but these members of society who are just, like, bestowed with this magical power to, you know, they're like, the dead go to them, and then they embark on their spiritual journey into the afterlife. So really, you know, with the Egyptians, with mummification, you know, they obviously did that with their humans and members of royalty and all of that, but they also did it with animals. And it was animals that they thought were sacred and animals that they revered. And so those techniques and those ways were just passed down from generation to generation. And I think the need for actual taxidermy probably started when the trade routes opened up. So, you know, with the Silk Road, people were going from Europe into Asia and seeing animals and seeing the things, like animals, plants, everything for the first time. Like, you can imagine, like, how insane it must be to live. Like, I mean, now we have the internet, we can just look at anything, everyone has seen everything for the most part. But back then, you know, someone wandering into this new country, new scenery with everything around them that they hadn't seen before, it was started as a way to get the information back. So, you know, you can't exactly take this tiger with you. So what would happen would be, you know, they would hunt or they would go on these expeditions of for collecting and to take it back. Taxidermy just became like a necessity in a way of like, okay, how do we convey this information? How do we convey, like, this is a tiger, this is what it looked like, and we want people back here, back home, to see what this looked like. We want the scientists to dissect it and study it. We want to have a representation of it in the museums or in personal collections or, you know, in the palaces.
What do you think the impulse is to stuff an animal in such a way that it looks alive rather than in a way that it looks dead, you know? So
oh,
if you're thinking of, right now I'm looking at this lovely, oh, he's a bobcat?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, he looks great. as opposed to this fox
right.
skin here or you know, an animal
like
head mounted on the wall, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it comes from a couple of things. Like, with the heads on the wall, a lot of time they use the head, like, it was just a head on the wall because it's a big animal. Like, a deer is huge, and most people don't have the room for the hide to be mounted from head to toe. Like, these, you know, these animals, they're big. That, I think, so partly for practicality. I guess the poses kind of go with sort of the cultural trends, too, that are at large. So, I mean, in the Victorian era where everything was, you know, that's seen as, like, the golden age or, like, the boom age for taxidermy, like, back then everyone had, like, a dome or everyone had, like, this piece of taxidermy or something dead, like some hair jewelry or something like that in their home. And it was, I guess, just this reminder of, you know, what the world is like. You know, people were moving to bigger cities then, so they wanted these reminders of nature. So kind of like, you know, how we have houseplants and stuff, they, you know, it was just normal for them to have some, you know, to have some birds or have a deer or something like that. And the other thing, too, like, I think some people who are going for it for, like, the trophy way, like, a lot like, you know, like, people wore shrunken heads of their enemies and drank, you know, wine out of the skulls of their enemies that were conquered. I think a lot of it, you know, a lot of the trophies that, if they're made to look dead or, like, you know, like the bearskin rug on the ground, it's, you know, it's just seen as like, okay, I am this macho dude and I've conquered this bear.
Right,
and, like,
I've dominated
walk,
this
yeah,
bear.
I've dominated
as opposed
this
to having
bear.
The bear standing in your corner,
yeah.
That's, you know, look at this noble
yeah,
beast.
Yeah. So I think that could be part of it. What I think is cool now is people are doing sort of these like hybrid type of mounts, like soft mounts, or I've seen rugs where like half the rug looks like it's, you know, it looks like an animal rising out of the floor. It's kind of insane looking, but I'm like, it's new and it looks kind of, you know, kind of like creepy and cool, but and then there's this sort of like in between line where, and I kind of like that line too. I don't really work in it, but there is this sort of like functional taxidermy where people make like, you know, squirrel head beer openers or like, you know, like I think there was one year at the Rogue competition where this guy made, I think it was a coyote, and you could like pour like whiskey out of its front and like wine out of its back or something. you know, something insane like that, or it was like a cooler, like it was a cooler inside. So I think like in like now people kind of do all sorts of stuff with it because we've seen most of the animals, we have the taxidermy in the museums, and you know, most of the time you can have like artistic license after a while.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of alligator claw back scratchers
at
airports and stuff in Florida.
Like yeah, that's so funny. In Florida, there's so much of that like alligator stuff everywhere. Like all those heads. Like,
I know. So how would you describe the pieces that you do?
So the pieces I do, they kind of fall into two categories. Mm-hmm. There's the stuff I do as commissions, which is really what the it's what the customer wants.
And in that case, is someone bringing you the piece, or do you have to go out and find it?
It depends. Most of the time, it's them bringing me, you know, them bringing me something. Whether it's like right now, I'm working on a lady. She had a sugar glider that passed away, so you know, something like that, where it's a pet, and she's like, I want to, you know, pose this way. I want her to be like with this expression. So I'm really just creating what she envisions. And sometimes it'll be sometimes commissions will also be people will see like a piece I've sold in the past, or they'll see a piece I currently have, and they'll say like, well, I want something like that, but you know, the space I have to hang it in is like, you know, 7x12, and it needs to be smaller, or it needs to be bigger, or you know, can you do something like this in these colors? It could be like a modification. And sometimes it's people also bring me stuff like, here's like a coyote pelt that I have. Can you mount it up for me? I just want it to be like, you know, standing. And the stuff I do for myself is more sort of fantasy taxidermy. I feel like that's the best way to sum it all up, because there's a lot of different stuff. So yeah, really inspired by like mythology or fairy tales, and you know, and like personal experiences I've had with animals, and kind of trying to present animals in like a different context.
Yeah, so just for everybody listening at home, we're in your apartment right now, and we're sort of just like surrounded by a little menagerie here, which is so great. Which of these pieces are yours that I can see?
A lot of this stuff is vintage, actually. I don't really keep a lot of my work, which is, I guess, a good thing, I guess. That floral skull is one of my pieces. Mm-hmm. You can find a bunch of those online. Some of those little... That little piece in there, that was my first mouse that I mounted. I kept that. I didn't sell that.
With a little mirror.
Yeah, a little mirror and with all the, like, witchy stuff.
Yeah. They're both very romantic.
Yeah, thank you.
So a little while ago, you mentioned that it's not legal, I think, to just pick up roadkill off the road, which I didn't know. Can you talk a little bit more about like the legal limitations on taxidermy and that sort of thing?
Sure. So every state has different laws, and the laws also vary by animal. They can vary by, you know, they can also vary by season too. A lot of states say if you, you know, if you want to possess something, it has to be within the hunting seasons. Sometimes in certain states, like, you can't just pick up roadkill. Like, you know, you either need a collector's permit. In some states, you need a hunting license to, you know, to pick it up, and then you can possess it. But then again, only in a season. So I always just say, like, for anyone who wants to go and collect stuff, if you're not, like, you know, buying like, you know, something that's a byproduct of food, just go and check your state laws. Like, they're, you know, they're online. You can go to like the DEC or the Fish and Wildlife website. Another law a lot of people overlook is the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and that is a law that protects birds. It came about because, you know, we were killing all the birds for fashion, you know, for hats, and like, you know, they're all so beautiful, and we're like, let's put them on everything, and then we're like, oh,
where'd the birds go?
Like, we killed the last passenger pigeon, like, you know, things like that really spurred conservation laws like this. So it protects most birds, and, you know, that's a question I get a lot in classes, is people will say, okay, cool, so I'm going to take the bird class next because I have this, like, blue jay that flew into my window, and I'm like, nope, you have to put it back. You can't have
that.
You have
so no birds across the board?
Not across the board. There are certain species that are not protected. The English sparrow, it's considered invasive. The European starling, also considered invasive, and the feral pigeon. Those three are not protected. So those are ones that, you know, you can legally possess. But again, like, some states you can possess them but can't sell them. Like, you know, it's always good to just check the most check the most recent laws. Yeah, but domestic birds and, you know, when people hunt birds, like, within season, there are laws for that, too. So there are, you know, permits that a taxidermist would have to, you know, to mount someone's hunted bird and all of that.
I have a cat that I love dearly, and when she passes into the great beyond, I would like to either have her mounted or have her skeleton articulated.
Yeah.
But the problem is she's in Florida. So, like, I wouldn't be able to bring her remains up here, right?
Or you'd be able to do that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, she has to be frozen and usually have to say, like, I'm shipping my dead cat to, you know, to do this.
Yeah.
And that's more for, I mean, so you should obviously pack her in, like, a cooler with ice packs and dry ice and, you know, with insulation and stuff. But, you know, that's also for them to know, like, what is, you know, what is being sent.
Right.
But people ship, like, a lot of stuff, you know, I get packages all the time that
really?
Are critters. Yeah. Yeah, people ship critters all the time. It's just knowing, like, which ones can cross state lines and which ones can't. Usually with pets, like, you know, if it's yours, if it's documented, you can do it as long as it's going to someone else that is allowed to possess her. So, you know, if you're sending it to a taxidermist, like, you can, you know, you can have that. But it's interesting you mention cats and dogs because there is a law with cats and dogs, too. A lot of people are like, oh, like, I want, you know, I want to buy a mounted kitten from you because they're cute. And, you know, if you come across a stillborn kitten, like, let me know and I'll buy it from you. And I'm like, nope. Can't sell that to you. In the U.S., you can't sell dog and cat fur. So
interesting. Why is that?
It's in 2000, they passed this act called the Dog and Cat Fur Act, and people say it's because, I forget who they say it was, I think it was Burlington Coat Factory, but we can just say, like, some major retailer was...
Sure, yeah, we'll protect their anonymity. Yeah.
Some major retailer was selling fur and fur-trimmed jackets that were labeled as, like, you know, Chinese water dog or, like, just something. They were labeled as something that didn't exist, and it found it, yeah, and they found out it was, like, just domestic dogs and cats.
Wow.
And it just upset people, you know, like, it just, like, made a lot of people really upset. They were, like, basically because people are really connected and emotionally attached to dogs and cats, we passed that law making the trade of their fur illegal and selling their fur illegal.
What is the hardest animal to taxidermy, in your experience, at least?
I think the hardest animal to do, I would say thin-skinned birds are really hard to do, just because, you know, the thinner something's skin is, the more delicate it can be. Piglets are really difficult as well. With fur, you can cover up so much, but with something that has really thin skin or really really thin hair or, like, no hair at all, you know, everything has to be even more perfect than perfect.
And have you ever been mounting something and just completely ruined it?
I would say that happened to me when
to
I first... when I first started, like, when I was, you know, just doing this as a hobby, like, I don't have a lot of my first mounts because after a year or so, I was just embarrassed and was like, wow, why would you ever do that? Like, now I was like, you know, you should have proof of your, like, not-so-perfect work. But, yeah, I feel like the more you do, the more, like, the less that happens, you know, like, and... There are also things to, you know, the more experience you get, the less likely you are to completely ruin something. Sometimes clients will bring me, like, I had a lady bring me her pet rat, and I told her, you need to put her, like, in the freezer, you need to, you know, I gave her all the instructions on how to keep her nice and cold and frozen until she got to me. She said she did it all. She gave me the rat. I go to skin it. It loses hair on one side completely, like, completely gone. I knew, I was like, okay, well, this is probably for one of two reasons. Like, I know I've kept it frozen since you brought it to me. You either didn't freeze it or, you know, for some reason or the other, like, bacteria grew completely on that one side and sort of, you know, caused slippage, which is just the top layer of skin slipping right off. And getting creative, there's a fix for everything, so we decided that the rat would be sleeping on a pillow with that side down. You know, there's usually a fix for everything. Even in class, like, sometimes students will be like, oh no, I ripped a paw off, or like, oh no, I put a hole in this thing. And, you know, if you think of a traditional taxidermist and you think of, you know, what they work with hunted skin, so they were shot or trapped or something is broken somewhere, you know, it's all about fixing it up and making it look lifelike again. So there's usually a fix for everything.
Yeah. That's where the artistry comes in.
Yeah, that is where the artistry comes in.
So lastly, for most people, I think taxidermy, like we were talking about, is sort of a relic of the Victorian era. When I think of taxidermy, I either think of, like, Teddy Roosevelt and some, I don't
Explorers
know.
Club.
Right, so, exactly, like that sort of thing. Or, like, the Walter Potter Room Full of Rabbits.
Yeah.
But it's clearly still a thriving art. You know, you have classes happening.
Yeah.
There are more and more people getting interested in it and more people learning how to do it. Where do you think taxidermy is going in the future and how can people be innovative with it?
That's a really good question. I think there are a couple of ways people can be innovative with it. I mean, I think now with all the materials we have, you know, with all the technology we have, we're able to create, like, even more lifelike mounts as far as, like, traditional taxidermy. There are a million materials to make forms with, just, like, the pure, like, technological innovation of, you know, making something look alive again is there. And I think, like, for the non-traditional taxidermists, you know, this sky is really the limit, like, as far as, like, artistry, you know. It's kind of like painting. I think, you know, early paintings are, of course, like, everyone wanted to make something really lifelike, you know, or hyper-realism to really capture what they saw, like, outside the window. But as the art grew and as it moved on, you know, people were more about expressing what they felt in, you know, maybe a non-traditional form. It's like comparing Basquiat to, like, Michelangelo or something, you know, like, both are valid as artists, both are great, they both just serve completely different end products, and I think it makes sense that now is a time when people are experimenting with it, because, you know, we have all the stuff in the museums, you know, people can restore it, like, there's a lot of restoration work, a lot of museum taxidermists do the traditional work, they're steadily employed by that, but, yeah, we've seen most of the animals, I think most of them have been mounted somewhere in the world, so the artistic side just makes sense that people want to try something new. And I think now people are attracted to it because I think for the same reason they're attracted to a lot of things like, you know, making pickles or like making bread from scratch. Like, we have this luxury of time, at least here, like at least in the U.S. Everyone has a hobby. Everyone is taking up a hobby. Everyone is experimenting with, you know, trying something new or trying something different. That luxury of having all this time and the availability of information and the speed of information just traveling makes a lot of hobbies that would once be something that was closed off or you had to be either in the know or part of some society. Now a lot of those walls and a lot of those barriers are breaking down.
Thank you for listening to the Morbid Anatomy transmission. You can see some of Divya's gorgeous creations at d-i-v-y-a.com. I'll also include a link in this episode's description. If you're interested in participating in a workshop with her or any of the other Morbid Anatomy taxidermists, you can find out everything you need to know and more at morbidanatomymuseum.org. There are workshops every month, and in some upcoming classes you could be mounting a fancy chicken, a tarantula? A skunk? You gotta get in on this. Maybe you're intellectually fascinated by taxidermy but don't want to get up close and personal with it. You should check out Walter Potter, The Man Who Married Kittens, a new documentary on the history of anthropomorphic taxidermy by Ronnie Thomas, debuting on April 18th. Again, the information for this can be found on the museum's event page. For any unanswered queries, please email info@morbidanatomymuseum.org. Today's last words come from Alex, the African gray parrot, who said, "You be good. See you tomorrow. I love you."